Hey, welcome back. The Greg Kelly podcast continues. And just a real quick thing. Hey, we all want Chris Pelosi to be well and walking around. Wait, is his name Chris? Paul Pelosi, 82-year-old Paul Pelosi. We want him to be well, and we're sorry that anything happened to him. But that is a very, very weird case. We all know it. If you watch my Newsmax show, I went through it. The police made a very vague statement. A couple of things that were fascinating to me. They did not say how Mr. DePape got in the house. They purposely, or whatever, for whatever reason, they did not say that. They also did not say, well, they called it a welfare check. They didn't say anybody called 911. Why not? Why are they calling it a welfare check? Now we're hearing later that day, they acknowledged that a phone call seemingly from Pelosi was made from the bathroom. I actually don't even know if the police said that. You have to look at what the police have actually said and what people are saying. So this whole thing about where's Nancy, that would suggest there's a motivation here to get Nancy Pelosi. But the police have not said that. They have had two public hearings. It's Sunday afternoon right now, and they have not said that. They said it's Friday morning. They did not say that. And they did not say it at their evening press conference on Friday morning. They have not had one since. Chief Scott, I believe his name is, has only put out one statement. And on Twitter, actually, he made two public statements. But on his Twitter right now, there's only a link to the first one. Look, I just am curious. There are outstanding questions, and it's fair to ask them. Is there a pre-existing relationship between DePape and Pelosi? Who was the third person? There was somebody else. And at the evening press conference, they acknowledged this, that someone else other than DePape and Pelosi opened the door. And two men were holding a hammer. Were they struggling? They did not say that. They said the struggle started after the police got there. This is so weird. They're speaking in such a circumspect manner. And the media seem to just, they're presenting a story that they want to tell, but the facts have not been established. Now you could say, well, they have sources. Well, watch out for the sources. And the source they most often cite is somebody from Nancy Pelosi's office who they say was briefed on the matter. By whom, it's unclear. Was it the police? Why are the police telling Nancy Pelosi's office one thing and the public something else? Isn't that odd? And then they want this January 6th narrative. They're going right back to it. The Sunday shows, they're already saying to Republicans, well, shouldn't we take off all of the ads that criticize Nancy Pelosi? Huh? Got 9 days to go before the midterms, and they want now to... I have questions. It's a fascinating case to me that they're skewing this, I do believe, and they're leaving out details on purpose. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, today I'm talking to Nelson DeMille, the author, the legendary author. Nelson DeMille is one of my favorites, a great novelist, and one of the things I like about him so much is he served in Vietnam as an Army officer, and he was in the insurance business. Why is that cool? He's a full-time novelist, and he made a switch. First of all, he went into the Army. He went to Hofstra University. He grew up in Elmont, New York, not far from where I grew up in Baldwin and then Garden City. And then he lived in Garden City, and he's a real down-to-earth guy. He's very funny. He's not particularly politically correct, and that comes through in his novels. And, you know, let's face it, times have changed a little bit. But his characters, you know, his characters are his characters. The main guy's been around for a couple of decades now. He's not going to become a woke, politically correct guy overnight. Of course not. He's going to be true to who he is. Well, some people in the publishing world think that everything should be, oh, very nice and sweet and politically correct and non-binary this and that. Most of us are confused by that stuff. And it's okay. It's okay. And it's okay to be who you are. This is still America. And we're very pleased that Nelson DeMille is out with another bestseller. It's called The Maze, available wherever books are sold. Our conversation begins in a moment. But first, I don't know about you, but I like to wake up every morning knowing I'm doing something for this great country of ours. Ever since the American Revolution, drinking coffee has been declared an act of patriotism. Especially during these times, we can't forget what makes us uniquely American: hard work, self-determination, and individual liberty. Freedom doesn't brew itself, and that's why I drink Di Espresso Liber coffee. Founded by a Green Beret almost a decade ago, who developed a dedication to crafting outstanding brews after multiple deployments, Di Espresso Liber coffee is 100% Arabica coffee, sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world, and is roasted fresh in-house once they receive your order. The Di Espresso Liber experience starts from the moment you open the package. The aroma is almost as good as the flavor. I'm not kidding. I could smell the coffee through the packaging even before I open the bag. And although I'm no coffee expert or connoisseur, I can tell you Di Espresso Liber coffee is out of this world. Tasty, full-bodied, and smooth. It really gives me a delicious jumpstart to my day, rich in flavor and American values. Di Espresso Liber coffee encourages all of us to sit down together and unite with fellow patriots to celebrate our God-given rights. So, if you want to wake up every morning to a savory, micro-roasted cup of coffee that supports quality coffee farmers, America's special operations community, and our great great country, visit Di Espresso Liber. That's D-E Espresso Liber. I'll spell the whole thing. D-E-E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O-L-I-B-E-R. It's Di Espresso Liber. L-I-B-E-R. D-E-E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O-L-I-B-E-R.com. It's a veteran-owned, family-run small business whose brew tastes as good as it will make you feel. After all, freedom does not brew itself. And now, our conversation with Nelson DeMille, the legendary author. Nelson, how are you feeling?
Pretty good, actually. You know, I mean, considering I'm just turning 78 in a couple of weeks, but I don't feel like it. So I guess it's the good news.
What book is this? How many?
Oh, my God, this is like 23, and not that prolific because I've been doing it for 40-some years. So, you know, they expect 40 books from 40 years, but it's, for me, it's like every other year, every 18 months. I'm not as prolific as, you know, a lot of writers out there today.
Well, I mean, who expects 40 books in 40 years? Who puts that kind of demand? Is it the publisher? Is it the reader?
No, well, not so much the reader, the publisher. Whenever best-selling author, they want to see a book a year. And, you know, the agents, too, of course. It's all about money. But it's also about lifestyle, meaning my lifestyle, not theirs. Obviously, I'm not. I mean, James Patterson does two books a year, and there are other people, and he doesn't write his own, but, I mean, there are other people who actually do write their own. But I think the quality suffers. I mean, you know, it's 150,000 words. You just can't rip that off, and that's like over 10,000 words a month. A finished copy, so you know it's hard to do and maintain the quality. But some people can do it and do it well. Very few. Stephen King is one. He's a very fast, prolific writer, but also he's brilliant. He's a genius. But most writers need to, you know, they need to look at the words and make sure that what they want to say is on the page. And but you know, and I take my time. I'm not trying to get filthy rich in this business, and I'm fine where I am, which is one. And I think the reader appreciates the better quality, and the reader's willing to wait 18 months, 24 months between books. You know, years ago, it used to be, you know, every 2 or 3 years, some of these writers, like the Hemingways and Fitzgeralds, and you see their body of literature is like 10 or 12, 14 major novels in a whole lifetime. But now it's like one a year. Part of it has to do with, you know, the computer and, you know, how books are written, the way they're just typed. they're not handwritten and massaged and then, you know, through the typewriter. And they're just, you know, they're more typed and printed than they are written these days. That's my thought anyway.
Well, it's physically easier to produce a book.
Physically, yes. Logistically and physically. you know, the pages used to be carbon pages, and you had to do whiteouts and pen and ink, what they call pen and ink corrections on the page. And then some pages had too many corrections, too many whiteouts, had to be retyped. And you'd make new mistakes because it wasn't a computer and that type of thing. And then, you know, I'd have to get it to the publisher, which was a slow boat to China. And now everything is, you know, typed and emailed, and the printing process is faster. So, yeah, I mean, because you can get a book out physically and logistically in a year, doesn't mean you should get a book out every year. But unless you have nothing else going on in your life. But then you get into that thing where you just become an armchair writer and you haven't experienced anything. You're not Ernest Hemingway or somebody like that. And your life is dull and you're making it all up in your mind. I like to get out there with the boys and have a beer now and then and go travel, go on adventure. And that kind of stimulates the writing. And that's the way writing used to be. I'm like between generations. I'm not, you know, obviously not a writer in the 20s or 30s or 40s. A lot of these guys are World War II vets, and neither am I, you know, a younger writer who knows how to compose on a computer and hit the send button and send it to the publisher. So I'm kind of not, you know, I still handwrite my books. They're all handwritten.
Well, that's the thing. On you use a pencil, I understand, and you're writing what, on legal pad, right?
Yep. That's what I do.
And that's not easy. I mean, that's as logistically, you do it the same way now as you did 40 years ago.
Yes. The only difference is my secretary who types it is able to type it on the computer. So we can play with it a little bit and get a clean copy out to the publisher without all the, the ink corrections or without the whiteouts. In the old days, God forbid, you lost the carbon copy. When you sent the book out, you know, like a 500-page manuscript, all you had back in your office was the carbon copy, which was, you know, full of mistakes, because you can't white out carbon paper. So, God forbid the manuscript got lost, and then that's, people lost manuscripts. Ernest Hemingway left one on the train without a copy of anything. And this is like a nightmare. And Jimmy Carter once was halfway through his memoirs and pushed the wrong button back in the early days, you know, before you had the safeguards, and he erased, you know, half a year's worth of work. I mean, if you believe that story. But that might be for the better.
Wait a second. Would you travel? You say you're trying to, you want to see things. You're looking for ideas. You have to mix it up in life in order to write about life. So you're looking for things, are you?
Yeah. You know, sometimes I'm specifically on a research trip. Like when I went to Cuba for my book, The Cuban Affair, I went to Cuba, and then, you know, I went to Moscow during the days of the Soviet Union and Leningrad for my other book, and which was Charm School. And I went back to Vietnam in 97. I'd been in 1966, 68. I went back in 97 with a bunch of guys to do research for Upcountry. And, you know, a lot of my books have, you know, settings that maybe most people don't want to go to. Somebody said I should set a book in Tahiti so I can relax a little bit on a working vacation and not go to these places like Northern Ireland during the Troubles. I was there, and I was, some odd places because, I want my feet on the ground. I want to see what's going on there. And you do a certain amount of book research and a certain amount of interviews, but, ultimately you really need to be there. The only book I didn't really go to where it was set was The Panther. And The Panther was a John Corey book set in Yemen. And I was ready to go, but I was advised by somebody in the State Department who I knew, who said, this is not a good place to go. If you go, you're going to have to hire at least two or three security personnel, Western-type security personnel with, you know, some machine guns. So, I mean, I wanted to go. My wife at the time did not want me to go. My ex-wife wanted me to go. That was
enough. Wait, this is Yemen, right?
Yemen. Yeah.
Yemen is a crazy place. Absolutely. All right. So, by the way, John Corey, the name, how did you come up with that? Well, who, the name itself?
That's a good question. And I don't know. Obviously, subconsciously, it's JC. And JC is Jesus Christ, so we know that. But I always like my first names to be monosyllabic, like, you know, Ben Tyson and that type of thing. You know, most of my main male characters have one syllable first names. And this is the last name, you know, there's an art to naming characters. And because some characters, you know, you can pick it the wrong name, it just sounds bad. Sounds maybe slimy. It's got a lot of S's in it. It's got to sound, you know, strong. We don't want too many the MAC configurations like McGraw, you know, that type of thing. I mean, it's kind of overdone. But, you know, yeah, I really, and I think most writers really sweat over the names. They want them to sound good. They want them to be memorable so the reader can help, you know, can follow. And, you know, when I have right in front of me now a book called, I'm writing an outline for a new book, called 55,000 Baby Names. And there are literally 55,000 names in this book. And this book is an invaluable resource. And I'm trying to figure out the name of my new character in the new book. I know his last name is Truett. Truett sounds good to me. First name, I'm not sure yet. You can't make him John or Sam or Ben because I've already used those. So I'm trying to come up with something that sounds strong and yet, but, you know, but memorable. And,
well, John Corey to me sounds very real. It just sounds so real. It sounds like a friend of my father's. It sounds like, and, you know, my dad was in the police department for a very long time. It just sounds very, like, you know, it, not somebody I know, but somebody he knows. I just, because I hear names that of his associates, and a lot of them I haven't met, and that just sounds like one of those guys. By the way, has he aged in accordance with, you know, our real, with the years as they are? Is he as old as, you know, 2022 as he was in, say, when did he first debut?
That's a good question. Probably 97, I think.
So is he now 22 years older, or I'm sorry, 25 years older than he was then? Or have you, you know, does he advance? How old was he when you started out, and how old is he now?
Well, you know, when I started out, he was kind of mid-40s. It was my first John Corey book was Plum Island, and it was meant to be a standalone. So I wasn't thinking in terms of a, you know, series character. Because I'd never done a series before, but when Plum Island came out, it was like a huge bestseller. It was like 18 weeks on the New York Times list. And, you know, readers and my agents and my editors said, you got to, you know, make this a series. So I said, okay. So I wrote another book, which was The Lion's Game with John Corey. I'm up to number 8 now, by the way. But, you know, then I had to make that decision. In real time, you would be in the 60s, and that's not what people want. So I kind of froze time, and there is an internal chronology to the series, and it doesn't progress much. So when I'm writing, like I wrote the last one, The Maze, I had to make sure that the technology that I was talking about, whether it be cell phones or drones, really existed then. And then you get into the research of having to do research on recent history, mostly technological, like what existed. So, yeah, I froze them in time. And the internal chronology of the book, the books from Plum Island to this one is probably no more than 6 years, I believe. So John is approaching 50, but not quite. So the ladies, you know, are okay with John. we don't want to age him too much.
Well, but wait a second. Isn't he, he's flirting with retirement right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's been forced out of a number of jobs. And, you know, he was in the NYPD, wounded in the line of duty, so he had a 90% disability. So he took a contract job with the government in the Joint Terrorist Task Force, and he doesn't play well with the FBI, and so and then he gets in the Diplomatic Surveillance Group, the DSS, which is a real group. So you know he's had many second acts, and mostly with the feds. And when we see him in The Maze, he's been let go by the Diplomatic Surveillance Group, the DSS, and he is unemployed, looking for something, looking to get back into the action. That's how the book begins.
I wonder about that. People who are, look, this guy is at the top of his game in many respects. He doesn't play well necessarily with others. And a lot of folks are like, not a lot, but it happens. The better you are, the more the bureaucracy sometimes resents it, and it's funny. The older you get, the better you get, the harder sometimes it is for these guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see it in my business. I mean, I've been in publishing 44 years, and the business has changed. And I have, you know, I have a history. I can go back and think of how it used to be and what was better, what was not. And people I know, you know, I kind of grew up with in the business, a lot of them are gone, either to Florida or someplace else, like not around anymore. And, you know, but I keep getting offered, offers I can't refuse, so to speak. So, you know, I'm still in it, but I, you know, a guy like Corey is, at least he's younger than me in the book, and he needs the action. And he has no tolerance for bureaucracy. And we've all seen what bureaucracy can do. We saw that really, and you know, it was really highlighted in 9/11. A lot of what happened there didn't have to happen. It was just a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of people not speaking to each other, CIA, FBI, and the NYPD, that's a good intelligence service, as you know. They weren't playing well together, and you know, we all suffered because of it. And a lot of my books have to do with Corey cutting through the bureaucracy and always getting into trouble, but always looking for the truth and always looking to solve the case sooner than later. So I think the reader appreciates that too. He's a man of action.
He's politically incorrect, I think it's safe to say. And now, I mean, the culture is really changing. Do you factor that into the new book? I mean, now politically correct is kind of hard to figure out what the hell we're supposed to be right now in terms of a lot of issues. Is he coping with how fast the world is changing?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to answer that, but let me be straight. I have problems with this book. I had problems with my editors, and they were not happy with John. This is the old John Corey, but it was a new world. And they asked for rewrites, and they asked for different changes of words. A lot of this book has to do with the murder of 9 prostitutes, and I call them prostitutes in the book. I thought that was a nice word. They say, why can't you use the term sex workers and that type of thing? And some of his, you know, some of John's inner thoughts and some of his comments could be considered sexist, but they're funny. I think I have more female readers than male readers. I really think so. They get a lot of fan mail from women who love John Corey. But we had some real problems. There are a lot of junior editors who also read the book for copy editing or whatever. And apparently some problems came out of my publishing house. And they came to me and they said, we need some changes. And, you know, to be honest, I made a few changes because I didn't want to, you know, kind of push some of this politically correctness into people's faces. But I didn't make the changes they wanted. Basically, the character's still the same character. But yes, the world has changed. So he seems maybe a little bit more over the top than he did 20-some years ago when I created him. And I think a lot of writers are finding that. A lot of writers are just rolling over for it, or they're just censoring themselves before it gets to the editor. I did not do that. But some of them are fighting back and are saying, no, this is what I'm saying, this is what I mean. All right, so, you know, when you're dealing with the main character, you got to be a little careful. You don't want to make them, you know, unlikable. But I'm finding, too, that some of the minor editorial people, younger ones, are taking exception with some of the bad guys. I mean, I have some of the bad guys, and they are bad guys in this book, saying, you know, grotesque things that are, you know, semi-racist, semi-sexist, or totally sexist, and that's what makes them the bad guys. But it is so unappealing to junior editors that they want me to change that. They're asking, you know, what asking for basically is change your bad guys and make them nicer and a little bit more woke. No, they're bad guys. So, I mean, they're confused. I'm not confused. I know what I'm doing. But the woke crowd is a little bit confused. As you said before, we don't know what's acceptable. I only found out recently that sex worker is a better word than prostitutes and other words like that. So there's a subtleness to it, but, you know, but who knows how it's going to stand up 20 years from now. I mean, all my books are in print. the oldest one going back to 1978. And there may be things in those books that are considered either sexist or just unacceptable today. But that's the way it was. That was a snapshot of history. You don't go back into like Huckleberry Finn and take out the N-word because it's offensive today. It may have been offensive then too, but Mark Twain put it in there on purpose. This is the way he wrote it. This is a book written in the 1850s, and that's the way it was. But, you know, the woke crowd, politically correct crowd, is trying to erase history. And they're very Orwellian. I don't know if a lot of them even read 1984 of George Orwell, but unconsciously they are totally Orwellian, trying to rewrite history to make it palatable to them. And the other problem is these are mostly East Coast types, and they're liberal to this or that. But there's a whole country out there between the East Coast and the West Coast that reads Nelson DeMille. And this is what they're looking for. It's certainly not going to change my character. And they said to me, we're trying to expand your readership. I said, no, excuse me. I debut at number one every time. Don't try to expand my readership because you're going to screw up my readership. Let me write it like I see it. And it was kind of a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit argumentative for a while, but I basically got my way. But that was a good question. I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, I'm glad you waged that battle because self-censorship is a real thing, and there are people who are kind of just rolling over, possibly or not of your stature, or maybe they're earlier in their career and they're worried this, that, and the other thing. I guess, Mike, if you don't mind, I want to just stay on this for a second. These 20-something editors, and they're good people, they're not, but they're going with the flow, and this is very fashionable of the moment. Do you think they're trying to change the world? Are they just trying to make these things, like, they want to will a new reality into effect? Is it for cosmetic reasons? Is it so their friends will think it's, I just wonder what their motivation is, when they come up with these euphemisms and with this new language that is just, it's brand new. I mean, things are changing so quickly. I wonder what is driving them. Is it just to be fashionable? Is it to be, sex work is real work. I hear that. I wonder, and I'm sorry, I'm not really expressing this well, but I'm trying to figure out what it is, where they are coming from. What's their motivation?
Well, that's a good question.
For them.
when you find out, let me know. But I think you kind of hit on it when you said they're trying to will a new reality into the world. I think at some level they know what the real world is about, but they don't like that world, and they want to, they want to homogenize things, they want to pasteurize things, and they want safe spaces in their minds. And, you know, if it keeps going like this, the great American novel will have to be written someplace else. It ain't going to be written here. and you're right about the younger writers. They have to be careful, which is not only unfortunate, it's just unpalatable to me to think that some writers either self-censoring, but some of the newer writers would just have that mindset anyway, so they're okay with it. And it is, so yeah, it's become generational to some extent. Writers of my age, go back to a different era. And we don't want to sound like dinosaurs, but I've created this character, and this is who he is. And those characters, and you know as many NYPD as I do, and some of these guys can be tough and funny at the same time, and they can be a little over the top, but if you make them anything but, they're going to sound not real. I mean, people have a sense, I think, of what's real and what's not when they're reading dialogue. And, we certainly have come a long way in terms of, race relations and gender relations. But on the other hand, especially when you're dealing with bad guys, for them to, for the editors, the editorial process to try to homogenize and make, soften the bad guys because they don't like what the bad guys are saying, makes no sense at all. And the good guy, whoever the hero is in the book, is going to have to, has to straddle the line a little bit too. People do evolve, and I don't use some language that I might have used 20 years ago. But the other sad thing is that when you're writing a period piece that might have been set in the 40s, they still want to hold you to the same standards of 2022, which is ridiculous. I mean, you know, if somebody in 19, if it's a hardcore noir, as they say, detective novel set in the 40s, somebody's going to use the N-word. Sorry. You know, and that's the way it was. But the editors won't even see that. They don't even want to see that word. So, yeah, they're trying to, you know, create a reality, a new reality that's not real. And, you know, and it affects the writing. It only affects my writing. It affects my thought processes as I'm writing. And I'm saying, you know, what should I do here? And I don't self-center or censor. I do it the way I want to. But I kind of make mental notes to myself that I'm going to have a long conversation, a long memo from the editorial staff, and I've got to deal with that. That's what I had to do this time. In fact, we almost came to an impasse, but I prevailed. And this book is supposed to come out, by the way, in June, this past June, but. Because of, I think, the editorial issues, we're holding it now, and it'll come out October 11th. They say it's because of COVID and chain of supply and all that, but it had a lot to do with the long, drawn-out editorial process, which I had never encountered before in any of my books. And all of that editorial process didn't have to do with plot or storyline. It had to do with political correctness. So I wasted a lot of time on that was totally unnecessary. But again, I think the book that's out there now, The Maze, that will be out there, is the book I want. And I think, you know, people will read it and they'll make their own judgments. You know, if you're an adult, you can read whatever you want and make your own judgment. If you don't like it, put it down.
You know, can I just, do you think the battle, the back and forth may have helped you, first it gave you some awareness of the struggle that's going on right now, and it may have been difficult, you know, these 20-somethings trying to say, oh, you should put it this way. I feel like, you know, I told you, I just watched this show about The Godfather, and there's enormous conflict between management and the creatives. I mean, everybody seems to be out to sabotage this project, and my takeaway actually was that the project, the movie in the end, was better, not because those recommendations or those challenges were worthy, you know, they didn't have better ideas, but when they fought for Sicily and they got Sicily, they just made the most of Sicily instead of, I don't know. So did these struggles in any way, or will they prepare you for a better book next time, an even better book? Was there anything good from this battle?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think, maybe there was, but I don't think there was. Now, I'm just more aware that I can get away with a lot more as long as I'm, you know, getting true to myself. And yeah, and The Godfather, you know, they have some stuff there that's actual racist. We know that, but this is the way. How do people think the Italian mafia spoke back in the 40s and 50s and 60s? They were, you know, they used racist terminology. And you know, I have Italian blood. I was supposed to be offended by this whole thing because, you know, it showed the Italians in a bad light. But I wasn't offended one iota. I realized that what I was watching on the screen was very close to reality. And that's all it has to be. It has to be true to itself. And if it's true to itself, people will understand that it's true to itself. And when it's not true to itself, when it becomes very woke, they say that this... one movie that was pulled and it wasn't finished, Batwoman, was full of political correctness and it got so silly that it didn't make any sense. I don't know if that's true, but yeah, you can ruin a good project too by trying to toe a line, a political line or sociological line that's not part of the book, and you're trying to superimpose something on it that's not there. So, you know, did I learn anything? Yeah, I learned what I already knew. That no, actually, I was kind of surprised because I'd gotten away with a lot in my John Corey books and my other books. This one kind of took me for kind of threw me back a bit, and I wound up changing editors too, and I changed publishers. The same house. I'm still with Simon & Schuster, but it's Scribner's, which is a division of that house. And they tried to accommodate me to some extent. When you get to be my age, when you get to be your 70s, you don't take a lot of crap. You don't have a lot of time for that. And I think they did try to accommodate me. You know, I'm going to be fair to them. They tried to understand. They knew exactly where I was coming from, because that world that I was creating is a real world that existed and still exists. But the last two or three years of political correctness and, you know, the woke crowd is something new. So I think people are still kind of unbalanced by it. They don't know where to go. And they're all, it's more like running scared. And I think maybe some younger authors are running scared, and editors and even agents. And but I think when you know, if you're an author that's already done 22 books or 23 books, and you're a certain age, you know, you're not running scared. You know, it's not to me, it's not financial. I don't have that problem. So I can get away with a little bit more than maybe some younger author can. And I do read some manuscripts from younger authors who ask me to give them advice. And I can kind of almost see the self-censorship in it. Or this is where they're coming from. I don't know. But certainly, you know, the world of literature is diverging from the world of reality because of you know, the cancel culture, too. Some books have been canceled. You know, my publisher canceled Woody Allen's book, for instance, and it was because it's Woody Allen. He did something that maybe some people don't like. Well, so what? The man just wrote his memoir, you know, and people want to read about it. You don't cancel a book like that, but it was canceled. But I see the pendulum swinging the other way, too, Greg. This is interesting that a lot of publishers, and my own included, put out statements saying, you know, we do want to publish, you know, diverse opinions. So they're listening. They hear what's happening, and they hear the pushback. And if I had to guess, I think I would have less problems with the book I'm working on now, because the pendulum is swinging a little bit the other way, which I maybe is more hopeful than it is real, but I really believe that.
That's great to hear. And the CEO of Simon & Schuster, I believe, has been kind of is aware of this and has kind of staked out a line in the sand, if you will. You know, we're going to stay with this. We're not going to give in. Although I'm sure there's great pressure on him. Hey, let's get back to the prostitutes. I mean, sex workers. Is this a loosely based on, well, do me a favor. First off, when people say, what is the book about? Or if your editor says, okay, what's this book about? Do you at this stage need an elevator pitch? Do you have to boil down the book to a 30-second commercial?
You're supposed to be able to do that, but I can't. But this one might be a little bit easier, because this book is based on, I'm really inspired by, well, they're based on the Gilgal Beach murders. Which are local here at Gilgal Beach, Long Island, and, you know, my neck of the woods. But they've made national news, and there's been documentaries made about the Gilgal Beach murders. And what the Gilgal Beach murders are, 10 prostitutes or sex workers, they believe they're all sex workers, were found in the bramble bush, you know, near the beach. And these 10 bodies were found in various stages of decomposing. And this has been 11 years now, and the case is not solved. Nobody knows how these women got there and who killed them. But it was obviously the same person or people, because that's why they wound up in the same place. That was the dumping ground. And, you know, I found it fascinating that all the different takes on this. You know, some people are saying, well, because they were sex workers, nobody cared about them, and which is ridiculous. The cops all would love to find the guy who did this. And if nothing else, if not just because these women were human beings and needed and need justice, just for their own career and for their own egos. Of course, the police of Suffolk County, where this happened, are working on it. And it seems like it should have been solved. It's one of these cases that, you know, have some obvious clues, and people come forward, you know, get tips and all that, but nothing, 11 years and so that was the big mystery. And I just decided one day I wanted to do a fictionalized version of this. And I call it the Fire Island Murders, which is a nearby area of Gilgal Beach. And at first I had a different character, but then I decided to plug my character, John Corey, into it. He's the cop who pretty much solves the case, but not 100%. I won't give too much away because the real mystery is still not solved. But that's what it's about. If anybody is familiar with the Gilgo Beach murders, they'll know the background of this book, and then the locales are the east end of Long Island, the Hamptons, and North Fork, that type of thing. So it's kind of a nice locale, and it's kind of a modern parable about corruption, for one thing. Because there's been a lot of corruption in the past in the county at the police level and the political level. And there's a lot of suspicion that some higher ranking people in Suffolk County and the police department and in politics were part of this, that they were somehow involved with this. So it has all the elements of the Hamptons, murder, you know, that type of thing, sex, drugs. And it's a regular old police case. Because John Corey, after he left the NYPD, he's been working with the feds on terrorism, basically. So he's now back to being a cop. He's working actually for a private detective agency in this book. And he's going to solve the case. We know that right from the beginning, because anybody who's read the first 7 John Corey books knows that if John's on the case, this case is going to get solved. So that's my 30-second pitch.
Wonderful. Look, and since you, I'm glad you brought up Suffolk County and the police department, because you know some of this stuff has been written about. I mean, the commissioner of the police department went to jail and might still be in jail. His name is John Burke, and they're all that guy's got quite the past. Does he come up in this book?
Yeah, I fictionalized him, and you know, which is kind of risky, but I had the book vetted legally. He has just gotten out of jail recently, I believe. James Burke just got out of jail not too long ago, and he didn't go to jail for anything to do with the murder of the 10 prostitutes or sex workers, but something else. But something that, you know, was kind of like connected in a way. And you might remember somebody broke into his car, not knowing it was the car of the police commissioner of Suffolk County. And whoever broke in stole a big, I think it was a duffel bag. And in the duffel bag were a lot of sex toys and pornographic, you know, videos and that type of thing. So when I caught the guy with all the loot that he got out of the police chief's car, the police chief was obviously embarrassed. And beat up this prisoner, and for that he went to jail. But the connection was that some of the videotapes were kind of the snuff kind of porn, where the woman in the tape gets killed and that type of thing. And you know, this guy had a history of being a little bit rough with women, and he's always been, you know, a person of interest, as we say, with the Gilgo Beach case. So this kind of sexual toys and videos kind of, you know, maybe reinforced a lot of people's suspicions. But so far, no, he's not been charged with that at all, because the cases, there are no suspects. Nobody's been charged with anything. But he did go to jail for beating up the prisoner. But I think this case, you know, yeah.
One thing that's also even more bizarre about him, in my opinion, he was a witness to a very notorious murder of a boy, and he was a child at the time as well, a 13-year-old John Pius, I think his name was. Yeah.
Pius, yeah.
And he, this is it, back in 1979, he was found, rocks were jammed down his throats. And this guy, let's see here, he was a witness, and he helped the police, but it's very bizarre that he had a presence in such a notorious case. Do you allude to that at all in the book?
No, I didn't want to get into that, but there is a new book out, nonfiction, just came out about this whole thing, about this character of James Burke, and that's, you know, that's how the book starts. And yeah, he's got a, you know, I could have, you know, when you're writing fiction, it's easy to get, and when it's based on, you know, something that really happened, some, you know, true crime, for instance, you can get lost in the weeds, and it was really tempting to go there with this character. I didn't want to make him the main character, I wanted to make, John Corey the main character. But yeah, I mean, there's a whole another novel there. There's many books there that could be written because of all the things that have happened on this police force, Suffolk County Police Force, over the years, and also the DA's office, as you know, and also some politicians. So, we who grew up in the suburbs, I know you grew up here, we think the suburbs are kind of squeaky clean sometimes, and bad stuff doesn't happen here the way it happens in New York City or any of the other metropolitan areas. But that's not always true. And that's one of the things I bring out in this book. I mean, Corey in the book says this is supposed to be a mostly affluent county of educated people. And he says, any crime and any corruption that occurs here is supposed to be much quieter and a little more sophisticated than this. So he makes this ironic comment that, we're kind of revealing that there is an underbelly to the suburbs, that it's not all as 1950s and as clean as it looks. And I think that's part of the storyline, actually.
As you plan your next book and as you travel around, though, do you see that this is both good and bad, mostly good. It's going to be harder to commit crimes because of everything is being watched. There are surveillance cameras everywhere, the technology, DNA. It seems like it's almost impossible to get away with murder. And everybody knows where everybody is with cell phones. And I've noticed not the temptation, but the practice of, setting TV shows and more books, in the 80s, in the 90s, because present day, it also seems like a lot of intrigue has left life. People are in these little narrow digital cocoons and everything is very bureaucratized. Have you noticed that? Have you observed that? And is it going to impact your future books? Because this one I sense is very much up to date, but is that something you have to cope with?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's one of the major problems. I mean, you touched on one of the major problems of writing, and every writer will tell you that. Cell phones being the biggest technological advancement. But in the old days, when you had somebody lost in the woods, they were lost in the woods and somebody was tracking them. Now they pick up their cell phone and say, I'm being followed. So you have to have some, devices like, the cell phone went dead or I lost my cell phone, that type of thing. It's we're all so connected through surveillance cameras and electronic signals that we're sending out. Makes the old-fashioned whodunit very difficult. And but when you set a book in the 80s and 90s, it's a lot of research because you have to go back and say what did exist then. So you're doing a lot of a lot of period research. You don't want anachronisms creeping into an 80s book or a 90s book, and not just technical anachronisms, but also speech anachronisms, that type of thing. But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of books now set in World War II, which is kind of the golden era of, America, type of thing. And then the 50s, 60s, and people are trying to avoid the dawn of cell phones and the dawn of surveillance cameras. And I had a little bit of that problem with this book, in this book, too. Those women, of course, all had cell phones with them, and when was the last time the signal pinged and that type of thing? And then you get lost in the weeds and the storyline gets confused. So you try to make it as clean as you can, but still give a nod to the technology that's out there. But it is a challenge. I mean, it really is a challenge. And the book I'm writing now is set in the present, but a lot of it is set overseas. So not that technology doesn't exist overseas, but you can get away with a little bit more. You're right. It's hard to get away with the crime in America today, unless you're rioting in Minneapolis or Detroit or Seattle and burning down the city. Then it's different. But individual crimes are, and the police are so far advanced than they were even 20 years ago, with everything from DNA to be able to track cell phones, and yet even if you know this stuff backwards and frontwards, you got to be careful how much you put in because it'll drag down a story and the reader, the reader's eyes start to roll and you don't want that either. So it's a line you got to draw. At the same time, you got to draw the line with the enemy. The political correctness, maybe not so much that, but the, you know, how, and you have to recreate a voice that you think somebody, you know, would use in a particular situation. The cops talk one way and other people talk other ways. So it's a challenge. It's become more of a challenge.
I know you're friends with Bill O'Reilly, and you and Bill seem to work in a similar way, my perspective. I don't read the book reviews very often. I hardly ever, I think fewer people read the book review section of the New York Times than ever before. That's just my sense. But I feel like both of you guys work for the audience, very much the audience, the reader or the viewer. And those who are really great, the giants in media, work with the audience in mind. The minor players, the mid-tier players, or the elite players who have small audiences, like the PBS crowd, they're worried about the critics and they're worried about their peers more than anything else. Does a voice ever go off in your head? First of all, is that observation correct? I mean, it's all about the audience, and I feel like the best content creators are worried more about the audience than the critics. And the critics can be, you know, there are people out there who kind of write for the critics and they're afraid of what they're going to say and they're afraid of criticism.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you're absolutely right. And you made another point too. You know, a lot of writers do write for the critics. They also write for their editor. Once you got an editor kind of figured out, which is not good, but you know, when I figure out my editor, I know what I can slide past. I know how to slide it past an editor. But the other point you made is that now they're writing for their peers, and they're, you know, producing things for their peers, because peer pressure has become a new phenomenon. It used to be you worried about the critics, the bad writers, and the bad producers, and the bad directors worried about the critics, but now they're worried about and not worried about the audience, but now they're worried about their peers, what other people are going to say about them. So you know, that's a whole. Another thing that kind of kills creativity, and but yeah, you know, I have my eye on my audience, and because of here's one good thing about technology. I used to get hundreds of fan letters, you know, handwritten and typed every year back in the 70s and 80s. Now I get thousands because of email, and my website, NelsonDeVille.net, if anybody's interested, has a mailbox. So now I get thousands of fan letters every year, and I can, from them, kind of understand if I am making a mistake, if I am going astray. I listen to my readers a lot better than I would listen to critics. Do I read my reviews? Yeah. I used to care back in the 70s. Some of these reviewers were kind of giants in their own right, and they were powerful reviewers back in the 70s and even into the 80s. But now I don't think there's any reviewer of that stature that I can think of. Sometimes, you know, an author is asked to review another author's books. I haven't been asked in years, but I used to be asked. And, you know, you don't want to do it because, you know, if you don't like the book, what do? You know, the guy probably or the woman put a heart and soul into it. You don't want to be the bad reviewer. But most reviewers are not, either they're not read or they're read with a grain of salt, people I think understand instinctively where the reviewer is coming from. And I've gotten reviews that were political, that were not anything to do with the book. One reviewer didn't like what I had to say about gay guys, and there was nothing in there, nothing negative about gays in that book. But he saw something that he didn't like, and wasted two paragraphs of an 8-paragraph review on a 150,000 word book on something said about gays, for instance. And I got two bad reviews once from the San Francisco Chronicle, and I think it was the Examiner, two San Francisco newspapers, of how I treated women in the book. And the women that they were talking about were, well, one of them was a homicide detective herself, very strong woman. And there was nothing negative about her, but apparently the reviewers saw something negative. And that's the thing, you know. You read reviews now, Greg. You read them for a laugh, okay? Mm-hmm. Same with movie reviews. I read movie reviews all the time for a laugh. because you know that these people are in another universe, and they're not reviewing the content, they're reviewing the politics of it.
Is there a joy that comes from this process? And it sounds, anything worthwhile is work, obviously. I think this is work, and work is rewarding. Work is a gift. But does the word joy ever apply to what you do? Is there joy during it ever, or is there joy after it? Is there joy in the book tour? Is the word joy, if you don't mind, does that is it applicable at all to any part of this process?
Well, maybe. And you know, the expression is, I hate writing, but I love having written.
Yeah.
And, the two best words in any manuscript are the end. I put at the end of every manuscript. And but you know, yeah, you do have moments. You have euphoric moments when you're writing stuff that you really feel is incredibly good. And you take some comfort in the fact that you still, you know, after 20 some books, still have it. The book tour, you know, you mentioned that because I have a book tour coming up. They have their really ups and downs. But if you separate it out, what is the up part? The up part, and you've been there, being in a bookstore with a bunch of people who were there to see you and hear what you have to say and question, you know, the book and get their book signed. I mean, that's a real high, especially, you know, with writers who are isolated for most of their writing year. They sit alone in a dark room by themselves, telling themselves stories, and all of a sudden you're out there with your public, and happy that they showed up at the bookstore. You know, other parts of the tour is the media. Some of the media, and I've done NPR, are there to ambush you, and you know that up front, and they think they're more clever than you are, but no, they're not. I mean, I've been doing this for years. I can spot an NPR reviewer who's a thinks he's going to ambush me before he even thinks about ambushing me. So, you know, it's it can be a little bit fun sometimes. And, you know, it's got its ups and downs. It's all got, I think every other job's got its ups and downs. It's mostly ups. You know, the cocktail party stuff, people come up to you, you know, well, Nelson, no, God, I've read everything you've ever written. And blah, 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 you know, so, you know, sure. I mean, but all right, almost all writers complain about something. You're not complaining about your agent, you're complaining about your editor and that type of thing. So, but these complaints are kind of shallow anyway. We know that, but we got to complain. But if we didn't like this, we wouldn't be doing it.
Wonderful. You know, I really bonded with my father-in-law, who's a physician from Australia, and he lives in Australia, and he comes once a year or so. And the first time we met, he was reading a Nelson DeMille book, and I told him that I knew you, and he just looked at me like kind of like in an astonished, disbelieving way. You know what I mean? Like that's not possible. How could you know him? And it was a moment that we had, and I think I grew in his estimation. He really reevaluated me after that. So look, real quick, how often do you think about Vietnam? You are a combat veteran of Vietnam. Does it cross your mind from time to time, every day? When do you think about it?
If ever? Maybe every day, and maybe because I this is what I do for a living. I've only written three Vietnam books. I don't want to be the Vietnam writer, but when you're writing any book, especially books that have to do with you know, manly pursuits and things that do with, you know, shootouts and you know, weaponology. So, you know, I kind of go back to my Army days and think about how did this feel to get shot at, and what kind of weapon would he use? I think about that end of it, maybe the technical end of it. I have a 16-year-old son who's fascinated by my years of Vietnam, and he has questions, so that compels me to think about it. And also, as the years go by, you think about, you know, when you were younger and when, you know, the, how do I put this, the social dislocation that was going on in the 60s, as opposed, compared and contrasted to now. I'm seeing those similarities, and this is kind of, you know, the last 2 years kind of harking back to the 60s. A lot of people made that comparison. So, you know, yeah, as you get older, you go back in your mind and you think of those moments. Would I do another Vietnam book? No, I think I'm done with that. But it certainly has colored and kind of influenced a lot of my writing.
How long are you in Vietnam?
I did the year tour of duty. I did the year tour of duty plus a couple of weeks.
What was your job?
I was an infantry platoon leader and with the 1st Cavalry Division. I'm sure you've seen Apocalypse Now with the air assaults and the helicopters. That was my job for a year. I got $260 bucks a month and $110 combat pay. It was the greatest deal going. And three meals a day for free. I mean, does it get any better than that?
How do you feel about the phrase, thank you for your service?
I think it's good. I use it, and I don't think it's forced or phony. When I first heard it, I kind of related to it right away. And again, from my generation, when we came home, nobody thanked us for our service. Believe me, nobody thanked us for our service. I was treated like a pariah when I landed at San Francisco Airport in November 68. And, I remember that. Like, those are very vivid memories of how we were treated. And I was angry at the time, but I think the country in many ways, and you were in the service, you know, the country has redeemed itself. I mean, you know, we don't blame the soldiers anymore for the war, whatever war we have to be involved with, whether it be Iraq, Afghanistan. The soldier, the sailor, the airman are treated well. And I think that's what we learned from the 60s. We may disagree with the government, we may disagree with policy, but the men and women who are out there doing their duty and putting themselves in harm's way are not part of the problem. So I think something good came out of that. And yeah, thank you for your service. And thank you, Greg, for your service.
Well, thank you for your service. No, it's so nice of you to say. And when you put it like that, it is nice. It is nice. And I basically, for a while, I had mixed feelings about the statement, but I think it's good. Actually, when I was on active duty, nobody ever said it. And then it became a thing after 9/11, which people are almost always coming from a good place when they say it. And it's nice. And we have come a long way. Can you just tell me real quick, your son, 16 years old, is he leaning one way professionally, educationally? What are his interests?
No, he's 16. You might have missed that. He's 16.
No, 16. I heard that.
I'm just joking. I mean, he's 16, he's not thinking about anything. He's thinking about girls.
Okay.
And
well, college will be here before.
At times, politically, he's kind of conservative politically, and a lot of his friends are. So I see this as a sign of hope. He's in a very liberal school and a private school, which is kind of woke and politically correct. But he and I think the people around him, including, you know, the girls and the boys, I think they're tired of being force-fed a lot of the woke stuff, and they're tired of talking about race. They have friends who are, you know, of all sizes and colors and ethnic backgrounds and religions, and they all get along. Like, there's no difference in that generation. They're fine, and they keep, you know, when this whole thing about, you know, white privilege and blah, 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 I think it offends them as young adolescents. And I think they're rebelling against it. They're rebels anyway. And if the politically, the regime at the moment is saying, you know, this, then they're going to say, no, the opposite of this. So, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge raising a young man and a young woman, I'm sure, in this environment today. But I already have two older kids, so I kind of remember how to do it.
Nelson, I think he has a great work-life balance. He's got it all going on. Such admiration and respect to what he has created. What he creates. Nelson, thank you very much. And thank you to our great sponsor, D'Espresso Liber, the great coffee, founded by a Green Beret almost a decade ago. This guy, these people, they really know coffee. The D'Espresso Liber experience. This is fantastic. And I am so proud to drink it and support it. If you want to be like me and so many other patriots, go to DeEspressoLaBear.com for the world's best coffee. That's DeEspressoLaBear. DeEspressoLaBear.com. DeEspressoLaBear.com. And, in the meantime, I think I'll be talking about DeEspressoLaBear.com on my Twitter, at GregKellyUSA. You never know what's going to happen there. And to be continued, many, many thanks, and we'll talk again soon.